A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sim. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar. That's the display department. With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 27. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are talking about Time Slip. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon in England. Hello.
In 1970, two teenagers on holiday find themselves next to a mysterious time barrier, and when they step through it, it brings them back to the time of World War II, 30 years in the past.
And they're going to have several adventures through this time barrier, and once through there, they're going to find out some mysteries about themselves, they're going to find some answers about their families, and they're going to find something about the future of Earth itself. So there's quite a lot of mystery ahead of us.
As you may have guessed, Time Slip was a children's series with a number of themes involved. The major theme being the abuse and misuse of science and technology. We find this both in the future and in the past in Time Slip. And another theme we find quite strongly, as often in time travel stories, is the nature of your present decisions and how they impact yourself and others in the future. So the present impacting the future and the past impacting the future and how you take your decisions become an important theme as well.
So it was a 1970 children's TV series made for ITV, that's the independent television company in Britain, made by one of their smaller channels called ATV, rather confusingly. It was 26 episodes, all about 25 minutes long each, and it was produced by René Goddard and Ruth Boswell. And René Goddard was, I think, specifically looking for a children's science fiction show for ITV that would rival Doctor Who, which of course was on the BBC, but she very specifically wanted a more realistic science basis. And as you've said, Brian, there's quite a lot about science and technology in this show and about the impact that that has on people's lives, on the future of the planet. So it was quite a serious, hard look at science fiction. But because it was a children's show, they wanted to, I think, ground it for the kids so they would have children as the sort of lead characters.
Yes, it certainly had a balance of being a children's show, but also having all this sort of science and technology content and being a pretty solid drama in its own right. It also seems to be a bit of a theme with ITV in the 70s and 80s that they were looking for something to rival Doctor Who.
Yes, we've heard that before, haven't we? When you and Xander talked about Sapphire and Steel.
That's right.
And I think we'll probably mention it again when we talk about another show from ITV called The Tomorrow People. As you say, ITV always seemed to be looking for the rival to Doctor Who.
And sometimes they were more successful than other times.
Yeah.
There were a number of characters that were central to Time Slip. One of the first being Simon Randall, a 16-year-old boy played by Spencer Banks. He was a very studious, science-oriented, sort of nerdy character who had the typical 1970 nerdy glasses. And he was always very interested to see how things worked and to get involved in figuring things out and these types of things. He was very keen to learn more about things, whether he was in the past, the present, or the future.
And Simon, at the start of the show, Simon's on holiday, as you say, with the family of Liz Skinner. And Liz is the other main character, and Liz is a 15-year-old, played by the actress Cheryl Burfield, who's actually 18, but she was playing 15. And if Simon is the sort of the brains of the pair, she's very much more the emotional part of the pair. She gets more emotional, partly in a traditional way, in that she gets upset about things, but also that I think she has initially sort of more of an emotional or an empathic feeling for some of the other people and the other characters that they'll meet through the time barrier. They make an interesting pairing.
Yes, they did make a good pair because it was very dynamic. It always worked well. There was some nice chemistry there. And as an element that you see in many sort of children's-oriented shows, you have the parents of some of the characters. So you had Frank Skinner, who was Liz's father, played by Derek Benfield. He was sort of a protective father who always wanted to make sure that she was okay and that Simon was okay because Simon was staying with them as they were on vacation at the start of the series. and he was very much the character who wanted to see that things were okay with the kids. And earlier in the series, he was a bit of a pushover. He wanted to make sure things were okay, but he wasn't very decisive and didn't contribute too much. But as things develop, especially in the later part of the series, he becomes more assertive and finds his role and what he has to do with this whole situation. And that was a nice little bit of development we had with that character.
Yeah, that worked very well. I mean, I think all the characters do change over the 26 episodes, but perhaps most with Lizzie's dad, Frank. We learn fairly early on, I think, in the first story that something awful happened to him in the past. And what it was is not entirely clear, but it's damaged him. One of the things that will result from the children's adventures through the time barriers, he will change and he will grow and he will become more dynamic as the show goes on. So that's quite interesting and well done. There's also his wife, Liz's mom, Jean Skinner, played by the actress Iris Russell. And she's also obviously very protective of the children and very worried about them when they've disappeared through this time barrier. And perhaps, you know, most interesting about her is that she has, we learn in the first storyline, that she has some kind of psychic link to her daughter Liz, although it only seems to operate when Liz and Simon are in the past or in the present. So it's something that as long as it's a time that she has experienced or is experiencing, she has some sort of psychic link to Liz. She knows roughly what's going on and she gets flashes when Liz is in trouble and in danger and things like that. So that's quite interesting to explore.
It was an interesting way they did things with the parents, because the mother was the more important one than the decisive one and the one who wanted to really take care of things, and the father was less decisive and less outgoing, which was a little bit the reverse of what you might expect from something from 1970, so that was nice. And the weaker character develops to be a little stronger, and the stronger character, Jean Skinner, develops in her own way as well, so that was nice. And then we come to Commander Trainer, played by Dennis Quilley, and he was a very interesting and enigmatic type of character. What happens is in the first serial, when the Skinners and Simon are on vacation, they meet Commander Trainer there as well, this retired military officer. And as things develop, you find out that Trainer is a physicist, and he understands something about these time travel things that are happening. He was also involved in Frank Skinner, Liz's father, in Frank Skinner's past. He used to be Frank's commanding officer in the time that they traveled to in the first serial, so there is some interlinking and weaving back and forth between the different characters. Trainer becomes the guide to explain things and help Liz and Simon figure out what's going on and how to deal with the things that are going on. But he also becomes involved in things in the different time periods, so it becomes unclear whether he is good or bad, what his intentions are. He becomes a very pivotal and mysterious character.
Yeah, so as you say, he's very enigmatic. I mean, there's a lot to figure out in Time Slip as we go along, but one of the things I think you're always trying to figure out is what's the motivation of Trainer? Is he the good guy or the bad guy? And it's quite slippery as you go along to try and keep track of what he's up to. There's another scientist that we'll meet, although we won't meet him until the second storyline, and he was a character called Morgan C. Devereaux. His scientific research will be quite important as the story progresses, and he was played by a very tall, imposing actor called John Barron, who gives a quite dramatic performance when Devereaux turns up. If you've watched British TV in the 70s and 80s, you may recognise John Barron as the boss CJ from the Reginald Perrin television show, which might cause you a few problems when you watch this, trying to separate the two characters. But he's when he turns up, Devereaux is a very interesting character as well, and certainly very dramatic.
And there are hints at links between Trainer and Devereaux. Do they know each other? Well, quite possibly. And were they involved in some kind of projects together that are somehow involved in what's going on now? Well, we don't really know, but some of that is revealed as we go along and it unfolds over the course of things.
Yeah, that's right.
The time travel in Time Slip was different than what we're used to in most time travel series. It wasn't like time travel in Doctor Who or time travel in Back to the Future or most other types of series. How they did it was that when the children were traveling into the past, which is what they did at first, they were actually entering an echo of the past. And when they were going into the future, they were entering a potential future. So they were still in 1970, but they were seeing and interacting with 1940 or sometime in the future or whichever time was involved at that particular moment.
It's quite mysterious in a way, but when they're in the past, they're experiencing the past, and the people back in 1943 know they're there and can, you know, interact and talk to Liz and Simon. But in a way, Liz and Simon can't change the events of the past, and they have the same experience of the future, that they're experiencing possible futures. And as we'll see as we go along, there are a couple of different possibilities explored. And again, they can't really change it, but they can learn things both in the past and in the future, which may be useful to themselves and certainly may be useful to other people in the present. One of Trainer's sort of motivation seems to be to get them to gather information that he'll be able to use in the present.
That was definitely used to interesting effect. It was also explained that they cannot be killed or seriously injured when they're in the past or in the future. This gave you an interesting dynamic, because you might think that there would be no dramatic tension when they're traveling somewhere that they can't be harmed, or at least seriously harmed. But they did actually manage to keep a lot of dramatic tension in the episodes, in part because there was a lot of mystery over exactly how this worked, and was it really something where they couldn't be harmed, or maybe under certain circumstances they could be harmed, or maybe they could be trapped in the past or the future and sort of be stuck there and not able to get out. There were all of these sort of intermingled ideas, so it was a little mysterious as to exactly how this time travel worked. It was described as a time bubble that they were entering into, which was this echo of the past or this potential future that they were entering.
And it was quite interesting because, as we've said, with all this science going on, with this attempt at a hard science basis for the show, and they actually had a chap called Peter Fairley, who was the science correspondent for the ITV News network at the time, and he actually crops up, I think, in an introduction to the very first story to explain some of the science that's going on and to explain how some of it fits in with current thinking for the time about the nature of time itself. So they were trying quite hard with the science stuff to make it interesting, but also sort of relevant to what was going on, I think.
Those introductions, I think they did two of them on the beginning of the first two serials. I actually thought those were probably the weakest part of what they did with Time Slip. The shows themselves were much stronger and much better presented and explained than the little introductions, which were supposed to explain things further.
Right. I mean, it was just interesting because he was a very familiar face at the time, because he'd covered the moon landings for ITN and so on. So we knew him, and it just seemed to give it this hard science sort of basis. But as you say, some of the stuff that's explained may actually work better in the actual dramatic presentation.
Do you believe, as most people do, that time simply passes away?
Passes away?
Yes, that the past is the past, the future, and all we can ever experience is the present.
What else am I supposed to believe?
People who lived before us released energy, just as we are doing now, by walking and speaking. And energy does not pass away. Some of us are beginning to wonder whether in areas where there has been an enormous release of energy, great events happening, shall we say, whether the past doesn't in some way or other persist.
Persist?
Yes.
Well, how can it? This is the maddest thing I've ever heard. Anyhow, what's this crazy theory of yours got to do with Liz and Simon?
You have a very close relationship.
So we talk about the stories themselves. We start with the first story, which was the first six episodes, and that was called The Wrong End of Time. This begins with Simon and Liz on holiday, and they discover some mysterious buildings in the countryside, and they find the time barrier, which we seem to learn it's something that only children can sense and only children can go through. And when they first slip through the time barrier, they're taken back to 1940. So it's World War II, and the buildings are now a research station, which is run by the British Navy, which is where they're going to meet Trainer, when he was Commander Trainer, and also Liz's father.
As they are at the naval base in 1940, not only are they there, but there is a German attack going on at the same time. A party of Germans had landed in Britain and invaded this naval base, and they were in the process of taking it over, right at the same time when Liz and Simon had shown up.
And that just adds to the drama, because we then have the German attack on this research station. And we find that, in fact, the German commanding officer who's there is also a scientist, and he is interested in what's going on at this research station. I think, if I recall correctly, that Trainer tries to convince them that they're just doing simple radar research, but the Germans are aware that there's something more to it than that. And actually, it all becomes a bit more complicated because it turns out that the Germans may be part of a breakaway faction of the German army who are involved themselves in a plot to overthrow Hitler.
And at the same time as you have these historical elements, you also have the beginning of the ideas about the use of science and the abuses of science and technology that can happen, because they are doing this radar research, but they're also doing some other research behind the scenes that's even more secret than the radar experiments. The leader of the German raiding party and Trainer had interacted. They hadn't met each other, but they had interacted before the war as scientists. So there were these ideas about the two of them interacting as scientists, but also as military men and enemies at the same time.
And while this is going on, Liz and Simon will manage to get back to 1970 through the time barrier, where they'll find that the 1970 Commander Trainer is, of course, very interested in this, because, as we find, something happened in 1940. The German scientist is still conducting his research in 1970, but he's now behind the Iron Curtain. And so quite what he knows has become very important to Trainer, and he wants the children to go back through the time barrier with specific instructions as to what they're to find out for him.
We also, for the first time, see a signature type of idea in Time Slip, which is that something that was happening in the past or that will happen in the future is very important to the present. So what this German scientist had learned and what he knew from 1940 were still very important, because he wasn't with the Germans anymore in 1970. He was working with the Russians. You also had the ideas about Liz's father, because Liz's father had served in that military base. That's why they were there on vacations, to help him remember some of what he had lost from the past. This was part of what motivated Liz to go back to 1940 after they'd come back to 1970.
That's very interesting, because, as you say, he's lost some memories and he had some form of breakdown afterwards, and somehow that is linked to the secret research project, and it's something to do with what Trainer wants to find out about 1940 that will help them in their scientific battle in 1970. So it's all very well handled, that part, and very well done. And it helps, I think, that they found a young actor to play the 1940 versions of Liz's father, who looked very much like Derek Benfield, who was playing the older version. So that worked very well. And of course, there was also this idea of the Germans, an invasion force of Germans landing in Britain in 1940, which is sort of an apocryphal story or a rumour that's been going around for decades and decades, and it crops up here, but it's cropped up elsewhere in fiction. I think most notably in the book and the film The Eagle Has Landed by Jack Higgins, which was turned into a film with Michael Caine, and they cleverly worked that into this series here, I think, quite well.
Now, if it sounds like this story is very complex and convoluted, well, it was actually played in such a way that it felt very natural and didn't come across as being convoluted at all, even though it was fairly complex and intricate. It was actually one of the simpler stories of the four that we have from Time Slip. That was something that was really nice about that series, was that even though it was a children's series, it still had some complexity there, and they didn't water it down at all. That was very nice. The second story in Time Slip was called The Time of the Icebox. It was another 6 episodes, and it was our first trip into the future, 20 years into the future, to 1990.
And when they arrive in 1990, when Liz and Simon go through the time barrier, this time it takes them forward to 1990, and they find themselves outside an Arctic research base, where they succumb to the cold, they're rescued, they're brought inside the research base, where rather conveniently they were expecting some volunteers to arrive to help them with their scientific experiments. So they believe that Liz and Simon are the volunteers. Then they find out a bit more about this strange place, the icebox, the research station itself.
This is where we start getting into more use of science and the risks of the use and abuse of science. We get into the idea of longevity drugs. In the future, we have these drugs that allow people to live for much longer than they normally would. And we also have suspended animation coming into effect, and we have the beginning of something that is quite important in Time Slip, which is the idea of cloning. We start talking about that a little bit. And they start going into things like intelligence enhancements and all of these different sort of classic futuristic ideas, but they were looked at in quite a nice way and in a way that showed you the wonder and the possibilities, but also definitely the risks.
And as you say, there's lots of science going on here at the Icebox research, and leading that science, I mean, there's various scientists there, but leading it is this character Devereaux, who we've mentioned, who we encounter for the first time, who's really, he's very authoritarian. He's definitely in charge, and he barks orders, and he's in charge of all these experiments to do with longevity drugs and suspended animation. And he's interesting because we know from the 1970 trainer that, as you say, he knew Devereaux. They were linked in some way in their scientific research, but that as far as the 1970 trainer is concerned, Devereaux is dead. So it's a mystery as to how he can be alive in 1990 and leading this research. So that's one of the mysteries of the second story. And another one of the mysteries is that, again, we'll start to see one of the themes of Time Slip, which is the children meeting future versions of themselves. And so Liz will meet a future version of herself with quite interesting and challenging results.
Every Time Slip story had a future or past version of one of the central characters, either the children or trainer or one or more of the parents. That was something that really figured into it. And in this particular story, Time of the Icebox, the 1960s, early 1970s ideas of computers came into it, of computers being incredibly powerful and computers being an authority. So when the computer said, this is the answer, then that was the answer. And if something went wrong, it wasn't the computer's fault, it was the fault of one of the scientists. And this became a running issue in that story, that something would go wrong and the computer would say that everything in the computer was fine, and Devereaux would look at the computer and look at himself and end up blaming it on one of the scientists.
Yeah, we've seen this before on British Invaders, haven't we? This 1960s approach to computers, that they would become all powerful and that they would tell us great things about sort of social development and how to run society. And as you say, I mean, Devereaux actually hooks himself up to the computer, and he has this sort of mind-computer interface that he does. And absolutely, as you say, if the computer says it's so, then Devereaux just takes that completely on faith. And if things don't happen as the computer says so, then it must be one of his junior's scientists' faults, and he blames them. It's all quite interesting stuff again, and very dramatic with Devereaux barking orders that have been relayed to him through the computer interface.
And the fact that he interacts with the computer in his mind and in the minds of some of the scientists makes him almost infallible. You get a pretty strong dynamic going back and forth between Devereaux and the other scientists, and Devereaux and the children, Liz and Simon.
Yes, we should remember again, it's children's TV series, so there's lots of drama and excitement and some cliffhangers going on. And I think it's time for my confession, because there is a character, one of the scientists at the base, and it's revealed that all the scientists are taking this longevity drug and that they are all much older than they appear. And something goes wrong, and at the end of one of the episodes, we find that one of the scientists has died and has aged very rapidly. And the special effects were quite dramatic, I think, for the time, and certainly caused, I know, some concern for some children, myself included, because I remember this quite vividly, that when I saw that, I'd watched the first storyline and enjoyed that tremendously. And when we got to the second storyline and this very unpleasant death with the very unpleasant special effect that goes with it, I have to confess that this is where I stopped watching Time Slip originally. Now, it was 1970. I was 9 years old. That's my defense. And you can work out the maths from there.
But now, some years later, you're able to come back and enjoy the other stories.
Now I can watch the rest of it. And of course, now I can watch the death scene again and actually, without giving too much away, just say that it's rather a lot of makeup and little more than that. And it's not quite as horrifying as I remembered it when I was 9 years old. But it's still very enjoyable.
Well, that's fair enough.
Interesting. I mean, they did have several complaints about that particular scene. And when they repeated it later on, they had to cut part of that scene out so as not to cause the same level of outrage and fright as it had done originally.
That's quite something, especially when you see it now to see what it's like.
I know, now I was thinking, goodness, what on earth frightened me? But at the time, it was quite terrifying for a nine-year-old.
Right, now we've got to get out of here.
Saren, how can we?
I don't know, but we've got to. We've somehow slipped into the future. And we're not going to stick around to be part of some new experiment or other. They think we're a couple of guinea pigs.
Do you think the time barrier is still there?
Getting into the production side of things on Time Slip, the initial development was done by Ruth Boswell, who was looking for something to come up as competition with Doctor Who for ITV, but specifically felt that Doctor Who had become increasingly more fantastic and less grounded over time and wanted something that was highly grounded in actual science. So she worked on this idea for something with time travel, and she ended up sketching out the first story and working out the basic ideas of this series with her husband, James Boswell. But she also wanted the ideas of time travel and how it was used to have some kind of basis in physics. And to do this, she contacted a physicist called Jeffrey Hoyle and asked him about time travel and what kind of model of time travel he might have. Is there something that might make sense in terms of physics that they could use in this story? And this was part of where they came up with this unusual idea of time travel, where you have a time bubble that is an echo of the past or a potential version of the future. And it grew from there, but Hoyle's involvement at this stage was quite key to how it was developed and the form that it took. Incidentally, Jeffrey Hoyle was the son of Fred Hoyle, another physicist who we will talk about in a future episode of British Invaders, because Fred Hoyle was the co-author of a BBC TV series from the early 60s called A for Andromeda. And that was an early iconic portrayal of computers being very powerful.
Yeah, that's something we're going to get to on British Invaders. A little tip-off for the future there. The writers of Time Slip, the first writer who did the majority of the episodes, I think he wrote the first 19 of the 26 episodes, was a chap called Bruce Stewart, an Australian writer who I think started out as an actor and then gone into writing. We have noticed that on the Wikipedia page about Time Slip, there are some errors, and I'm pretty sure that the Bruce Stewart it links to on Wikipedia is not the right one. The chap listed on IMDb and on the timeslip.org website is more, I think he's the correct one, who was linked with British TV. He wrote a number of shows for British television, including some one-off science fiction TV plays, which I confess I'd never heard of, but something called Andover's Androids and another show called Lambda One. So he had a background in some science fiction. He wrote all of the first two stories that we've talked about already, The Wrong End of Time and The Time of the Icebox. And then he wrote most of the third story, The Year of the Burn-Up. He didn't write the last episode of that story. I'm not quite sure. He was either, depends which source you read, he either was unwell or he just had too much work on at the time, or possibly a combination of both. But he was unable to finish the third story. And so they had to hand over to another writer, and the chap they chose was Victor Pemberton, who's, again, a quite well-known name in British science fiction writing, because he was a script editor from Doctor Who, and in fact had written quite a famous Doctor Who story for the second Doctor called Fury from the Deep, in which he was the writer who came up with the sonic screwdriver, first of all. And Victor Pemberton, he came in and finished the third story, and he wrote the entire fourth story. So that's the last seven episodes.
And we had a variety of directors doing Time Slip. The first serial was directed by John Cooper, the second by Peter Jeffries. The third one was directed by Ron Francis, and the first four episodes of the fourth one was by David Foster. The last couple, they went back to Ron Francis. So I don't know exactly why they bounced from one director to the other, but they did that, and it didn't cause any particular problems. It all seemed to work in terms of pacing, and I guess varied things nicely as well.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I think one of the things may have been that there was just scheduling conflicts for some of the production team, for the directors and writers, because I think initially Ruth Boswell's pitch was for just six episodes. And I think she just had the first story, The Wrong End of Time. That was quickly extended to 12 episodes, and then I think further extended to the 26 episodes that we ended up with. So that may be why some of the different directors came in and why they had to have a writing change.
It was also produced in multiple blocks. I believe the first two serials were in one block, and the last two were in a second block that was recorded a little later on.
Right, that would make sense, wouldn't it?
And most of it was done in color. Not all of it, but most of Time Slip was done in color, which on British television was not uncommon, but just becoming very common in 1970. But it turned out there was a strike at ITV at the time. A couple of episodes in the last serial, I believe it was episodes 22 and 23, were done in black and white instead of in color due to that strike. It was what they call the black and white strike, where the film crews would only do black and white work, not color work. That unfortunately limited the foreign sales of Time Slip, because as a property to sell in other countries for foreign airing, it was much less desirable because there were a couple of episodes that were in black and white. And now, as it turns out, the color versions of most of the episodes have been lost. So what we have now on DVD are black and white versions of Time Slip, except for episode 12, the last episode of the second serial, The Time of the Icebox. So on the DVDs, that episode is in color. All of the other episodes are in black and white. And in fact, it looks quite good in black and white, I think.
I think nearly everybody agrees that actually it looks better in black and white. And when that single color episode turns up, it does look a bit strange, actually. The colors are very bright, aren't they?
Yes.
It does take away a little bit.
Some of the futuristic clothing was a little bit too gaudy by our standards now in color, but looked much more subdued and at this point more convincing in black and white.
It was Time Slip was mostly filmed on sets. The sets were all pretty good, I think. Nothing too rickety going on here. There was some outside filming, particularly at the place called, which has become known as Ministry Field, which is the site of the abandoned naval base where the time barrier is. So they're obviously they're back there quite often throughout the four stories. They also have some night shooting going on, particularly in the first storyline when the children are trying to escape from the naval base and from the Germans. I suspect it's an artifact of the time that there is this, especially on a night shoot, you get this slight ghosting on some of the outside broadcast work, which gives it a slightly spooky feel. It sort of adds to it and adds to the atmosphere as far as I'm concerned.
There are some slightly odd video things happening here, in part, I think, just because of the surviving black and white copies of an original color production and just the state of the surviving prints.
Right, yes, it may be, as you say, maybe a transfer thing. We also have extremely bombastic theme music, which you'll hear a clip of during the podcast, which was a piece of library music by a British composer called Edward Michael. And the piece of music was called La Rite de la Terre, I think, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And I think that was just a stock piece of music, but it certainly it's very dramatic. And when they cut to the commercial breaks with a clip of that music, it certainly grabbed your attention.
Yes, it did. It was a big fanfare, and it sounded like it could have been from a 1950s epic movie.
Absolutely. So I guess that will wrap up our discussion for the first part about Time Slip. Please come back and join us for the next episode when we'll be talking about the other two storylines. And then we're going to go on to talk about some of the spin-offs from Time Slip, what we liked, what perhaps doesn't work quite so well, and we'll get to our recommendations. In the meantime, if you've seen Time Slip, do let us know yourself what you think of it.
I think we will have lots of good stuff to talk about next time. You can reach us at BritishInvaders@gmail.com, and you can find us at www.BritishInvaders.com. This is Brian from Canada, signing off.
And until next time, this is Eamon from England. Goodbye.